Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. It's nice to have you with us today. We have a lot of empowering information, the latest on health and nutrition, the first study published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Science Translational Medicine from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease says that probiotic skin therapy improves eczema in children. Well, when you consider how many atopic dermatitis, commonly called eczema, is the number one chronic inflammatory condition today, dry, itchy skin, rashes. The disease is most common in children, is linked to an increased risk of developing asthma, hay fever, and food allergies. And while available treatments can help manage eczema symptoms, current options can be costly and many require multiple daily applications. Probiotics, safe. They work. So we'll deal with that and a lot more on health and healing and slowing down the aging process. But also today, I'll be sharing a commentary. It's a two-part commentary because it's so long. The first part's today, and I'm just one of those people, and I know that I'm not alone, who believe that shouldn't we also be looking at what we've achieved as a human species for the good and betterment and safety and the health and well-being of all the citizens of our world. So I'm going to share with you some of those minorities in the United States who for some reason are never mentioned, their sacrifices, their struggles, frequently against massive adversity throughout history, but now they are excelling. Do you know who they are? If I ask you what are the most notable contributions from the, let's say, 300,000 to 500,000 people from Nigeria, how many would know? But they've made major contributions in Iran and South Korea and Latino communities and, of course, African Americans. If you listen to many of the pundits today, the ideologues today, many of the anarchists and neo-Marxists, you would think that everything about America is down, dirty, bad, and let's just junk it all. I say no to that. Yes, we have a lot of problems to deal with. I deal with them all the time on this show, as you know. But I'm not an ideologue. I don't look at who's right politically. I think that we've made a major mistake looking at left, right, conservative, liberal. Let's look at the problem, how it got created, and the solutions. And that's what we're doing today by honoring all the people and their struggles and why we have a better life today because of them. We're all standing on the shoulders of someone else. Shouldn't we look down at some point and say, hey, thank you for allowing me this more elevated position? Because that's what life is. One generation, the newest generation, thinks that they're the hippest, smartest, most technically savvy of all. But do they have that innate wisdom that comes from the aging process and multiple experiences in life? No, they do not. Are they interested in communicating with older people, the wise men and women? Or have we abandoned the whole notion of wise men and women? We just got old people who are decrepit, rotting away at home alone, depressed, eating cat food because they can't afford regular food, or they're in a gated community because they worked hard and saved some money, and now they want to play golf, but they're not committed to anything socially or environmentally or humanistically, or the ones who are on the street and don't understand how they got there. We don't have a healthy dialogue with older people. We don't have respect that we should have and they deserve with older generations. We just think that time that we put that away with in a mothball, you know, case up in the closet. No, it's not. So today and tomorrow, I'm going to show you how wonderful our life is in no small measure by the people who came before us or are here now. So let's acknowledge them and at the same time continue to offer our protests, peaceful protests, against those who would prevent that goodness from happening, progress from happening. So that's our show today. And I'm going to throw in a few sound bites from Australian media because I just find it a unique situation of all American media, all of it. I'm talking about historically outstanding papers, the Boston Globe, the Miami Herald, the San Francisco Chronicle, the St. Louis Dispatch, the Chicago Sun-Times, the New York Times, the Washington Post. None of them are being honest about the most important issues that we're facing today. So we will have some people who, at their own risk, are telling the truth about COVID. So that's our program, and we begin with the idea that probiotics are good for the skin. Well, be a child and be itching and have painful problems with your skin, and you try to hide it. But according to this new study, they're saying that genetic and environmental factors contribute to eczema, and I'm saying they're wrong. I'm saying environmental factors and diet, junk foods, sugary foods, saturated fats, lots of meat, those contribute, because that's what the larger science shows, not genetics. We blame too much on genes when they're only influenced by our behavior. So if you have a family, let's just say, for example, there was a family that I knew, a wonderful family. They had one son and four daughters, and they lived on a bridge. You literally had to walk up the bridge and then watch both ways and run across to go into their house. It was kind of one of those things you never forget in life. And they always were dancing, and they were the hippest people. The Catholics in my hometown were the hippest. They always had everything before everyone else. They set the trends. And they were all overweight. I mean substantially overweight. And then later, when they started to get married or left there years later, but everybody liked them because they were really likable people. There was never a down day with them. They never complained and gossiped and bitched and moaned. They were always there. And so I spoke with one. We were friends. We've been close friends throughout from junior high. We went to junior high school together and high school. And she was thin and very athletic. And I said, you know, we're told that this is all in your genes. She says, no, it's not. She said, this isn't what my grandmother did to overfeed my father's family. Everything was too much. You could be completely finished with a meal. There would be no more room, and an hour later she'd bring in, you know, something else for you to eat, cookies or something. And as a result, over time, you got used to it. We did the same thing. But it's not genetic. It's not familial. It is familial. It's what your family teaches you because you're a sponge. You're watching it. And she was just the example. Now she was motivating her other sisters to get trim, and from what I understand, they did. So understand that your child's asthma, your child's chronic conditions, including the effects on their immune system, much of that comes from their diet and vaccines, and then giving worthless antibiotics when they shouldn't be given. You should be giving healthy diet and probiotics, and that's what this shows. All the time, I mean all the time, when I've done all of these clinical studies, 44 and counting, actually it's 46 now with the two latest on anti-aging. I remember the best one was a group of kids all diagnosed with ADD, and they were bouncing off the walls. And one of the people who came, her and her husband are both medical doctors, and they have three sons, and she says they bounce off the walls all day long. Yeah, I had to give them Ritalin. Okay. Well, 3 months later, it was a 3-month study, met with them once a week. You should have seen the difference between the first day, yelling and screaming, throwing stuff all over the room. Any of you who were at 83rd Street at my office for 27 years, we had that giant inner room because 1900, that was the theater. So we had this tall ceiling, stained glass at the top, and we could have 20 employees in there. But when we did our clinical study in the evening, everyone cleared off the desk. These kids just trashed everything until the staff said, we don't want to come in the next day and find all this stuff all over the place. Okay. On the last day, perfect. Behavior, calm, focused, and then they had a chance to tell their story. And the doctor who said her kids were bouncing off the wall, yeah, because they had caffeine in the morning to get them up. And I'm talking about a strong caffeine. She would give them espressos because she said they would stay up too late at night. Well, why didn't you stop that? You know, weren't there any laws, any rules? Well, you start seeing that with a lot of kids who have professional, not all, of course, but an awful lot of kids who have professional parents, doctors, lawyers, who are out and working long hours, the kids are pretty much on their own. They're called latchkey kids. You know, they got a key to unlock the door. There's no one there when they get there for most of them. So they binge eat on the wrong things, and then caffeine wires you, really screws up your dopamine and serotonin levels. And so they got to exercise every day. Well, that creates a new set of hormone balance through serotonin and the dopamine receptors. Then giving yourself pleasure by learning something new. Learn a new word every day. That was part of their part of the protocol. Learn a new word and how to use it in a sentence every day. And then learn a language. At least by the end of the study, you have learned 90 words. Learn a word a day and how to use it. So suddenly, and they all choose different languages, and then the parents could not keep the old diet. It had to be 100% living food diet. Lots of probiotics, lots of fruits and vegetables, lots of juices. They had to have, I think, 4 glasses of juice a day. And so it detoxified them. And the diet itself only took about 4 weeks. That cleaned them up. Eczema, gone. Acne, gone. Over oily or dry skin and hair and dandruff, gone. So I did the clinical study on it, and that's never been duplicated. I wish it were, just to confirm it. But that's what you can do with your kids and see an enormous improvement. Now, from Rutgers University comes a new study published in Epigenetics, that gestational diabetes can accelerate your child's biological age. Now, that's very serious, because long-term health risks by prematurely aging your child by a bad diet, cardiovascular disease, high blood pressure, excess weight, all are killers. And that's why when we ask, is it true that this current generation, many will not outlive their parents? The answer is yes. We're going to see enormous reset in our and to our anti-aging efforts by people dying younger, not just from opiates or suicide, but because what they're eating is garbage. So understand, if you have gestational diabetes, if you don't change that, then you're in trouble. Your kid is in trouble. And from the University of Konstanz in Germany, they're saying that 10 minutes of rest will help your body fight stress. Just allowing yourself a few minutes of downtime significantly boosts mental and physical relaxation. That's important. So do we allow ourselves to understand that stress is known to have negative consequences, and our bodies have an inbuilt regenerative system if you de-stress by doing nothing for 10 to 20 minutes, just nothing, just relaxing and deep breathing? That's the outcome of this study. Isn't it amazing that people historically knew that, and now we have to have a study that shows that give yourself a rest break in the day and you'll live longer? Wow. From the University of Navarra in Spain comes a study about how processed food is linked to age markers in your chromosomes, meaning that anyone who eats your typical American processed junk diet, you're going to have a greater chromosome change that speeds up your aging process. Because what happens is that 3 or more servings of so-called junk food diet per day doubles the odds that strands of DNA and protein called telomeres, that I've talked about on this program a lot, found on the end of chromosomes, would be shorter compared to people who rarely consume such foods. This was reported in the European and International Conference on Obesity. Mind you, short telomeres are a marker of biological aging at the cellular level. You don't want that. You want to increase your telomeres. And by the way, I'm sure you know this, but each human cell has 23 pairs of chromosomes that contain our genetic code. And telomeres do not carry genetic information, but are vital for preserving the stability and integrity of chromosomes and, by extension, the DNA that all the cells in our body relies upon to function. But as we get older, meaning over the age of 35, our telomeres shorten naturally because each time a cell divides, part of the telomere is lost. So that reduction in length has long been recognized as a marker for biological age. And so this is why you eat processed foods, high in mixed oils and fats and sugars and starch and proteins. You're going to die sooner. That's the bottom line. That's the latest on health and healing. We're 60 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break, come right back. And when we come back, we're going to come back to an audio clip here. And this is a Dr. Rashid Buttar. That's Buttar. And he's going to ask why everyone could test positive. And we're seeing around the world, almost everybody goes in, gets a positive test coming back. That's not humanly possible. That cannot possibly exist. Now, that's aside from all the studies showing that the tests we've used are either junk tests and shouldn't be qualified at all, and that is not good for testing whether you're positive because it doesn't differentiate between current infection with COVID-19 or a cold you got 20 years ago. But if you start making policy based upon flawed science, you're in for a disaster of unimaginable proportions. So we're going to hear what he has to say. It's a short clip. Please stay with us.
The rate of COVID supposedly is going up. Boom, 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 boom. That's the rate of diagnosis. And there's actually an article that came out. There's actually a couple articles. And I'm going to show this actual screenshots of some of these articles as well as some of the doctors that have recently reached out to me or that have reached out to other friends of mine saying that this whole thing with the COVID-19 diagnosis increasing is not accurate because we have people coming in for a urinary tract infection or a kidney stone or appendicitis. And we do the routine check and it's being mandated to check for COVID-19. They test positive, so now we have to put them down as being positive. So the rates of numbers are going up, but the death rates plummeted. Hardly anybody has died of COVID-19. Now here's something interesting that I saw today. Multiple governors making announcements about the COVID-19, their numbers in their state. Different states, and yet the numbers they're quoting are exactly the same. It was 22 yesterday, it's 33 today. Exact same numbers in different states. So I don't believe the numbers anyway, but the more you test and you're using the RT-PCR test, the person who developed this test, who won a Nobel Peace Prize, he himself said that you cannot use the RT-PCR to establish an infectious process. And the gold standard of seeing what the test is, because remember, there has to be a surrogate. For PCR to work, you have to have a surrogate test, you have to have a gold standard, and you test against it. It has never, ever been established. Now, I believe, if you look at and understand how the PCR works, they amplify it. They keep on amplifying it till you start seeing a certain number of whatever you're looking for, a certain number start to appear. I believe that at this point, they're going to continue to amplify the test to the point that everybody on this planet will test positive. Already, the Centers for Disease Control has come out and said that with the current testing that they're doing, they're not distinguishing between antibody titers, serological markers, and virology. So serology and virology, they haven't distinguished that. They're kind of throwing all those numbers together. And the most interesting thing is that they've already established that they cannot rule out that if you've had a cold before, that you could test positive for COVID-19, which is what I said a couple of months ago based upon the cat study, that there were cats that had gotten the flu shot, never been exposed to COVID-19, and yet they were testing positive. So how many people on this planet have had a cold before? So that's about how many people will test positive, the more you keep on testing it. And so that's justifying their numbers. They want to propagate this fear, so that justifies the numbers, and the sheeple are following those numbers rather than looking at how many people are actually dying from it. And nobody's dying from it. The death rate from COVID-19 is less than half of that of the regular seasonal flu. And in certain places in the world already, the cat's out of the bag. In Germany, in Italy, members of parliament and members of the government have already come out and made certain statements. In Brazil, members of the government have actually sent in troops and investigators into some of these hospitals that are saying that there are 5,000 people that are sick with COVID, and they barge in, force their way into the hospitals, and guess what they find? Not only are there not 5,000 patients in there, there's no patients in there. In fact, the hospital is under construction, under renovation. Not a single patient there. And this type of nonsense is all over the place. It's all over the place. So start critically thinking. Start thinking about what the issues are, and don't jump on a bandwagon either way. Of course, unless you're a troll or you're being paid to do it, then, you know, just keep on doing the same thing you're doing. You've already compromised your integrity. That's fine. I'm not talking to the troll.
Let me just give something that reconfirms what he just said. This is the latest study posted September 12, 2020. Here are university students testing positive on the PCR. That's the government's mandated, Fauci-mandated, White House-mandated antibody test. University of Alabama, 1,368, tested positive. Hospitalizations, zero. University of Georgia, 798, tested positive, zero. University of Kentucky, 788, hospitalizations, zero. Ohio State University, 882, zero. University of Dayton, 1,042, zero. University, Illinois State University, is 1,023, zero. University of Iowa, 922 positive, zero hospitalization. Missouri State University, 549 tested positive, zero. University of Kansas, 479, zero. Kansas State University, 546 tested positive, zero hospitalizations. Penn State University, 215, zero. Louisiana State University, 366 tested positive, zero. University of Oklahoma, 135 tested positive, zero. University of Wisconsin, 169, tested positive, zero hospitalizations. University of Minnesota, 93, positive, zero hospitalization. University of Miami, 202, zero hospitalization. University of South Carolina, 1,443, zero. Add them up. The total is 11,018 students tested positive. Not one was hospitalized. They're playing you. They're playing as if you're an idiot, that you cannot understand just basic common sense and science. This is not difficult. Do not conflate the issue of who's positive, because A, it could be a false positive test. B, the tests are notorious for being inaccurate. They do not show viral load. They do not show all the different viruses. In fact, a recent study showed that people who are completely healthy, had never been sick, had every kind of virus in their body, including HIV and hepatitis. They had never been sick. So we are a test tube of viruses and bacteria, some good, some bad. But it's what you do to keep yourself healthy. I just want to let you know that if you start testing everyone, you're going to have an astronomical amount of positive, and that's what they're going to focus their public policy on, not how many people are dying. Go to Sweden today. Go to Vietnam today. Go to Thailand today. Go to Switzerland today and look at how many people are actually dying. And it's 1-2 per day, and way below what even a normal flu infection death rate would be. And flu is highly infectious in children, kills a lot of children, kills a lot of teens. You don't see that with this. So again, you're being played. Why? They want a mandatory vaccine. Why? Because if everybody gets vaccinated by country, you're dealing with at least let's just say not 7.7 billion people, but let's just say they vaccinate 5 billion people. They've just made themselves about $20 trillion. Now, we see politicians that will compromise their integrity for a few thousand dollars. Imagine what a person would do if they were tempted with the kind of money that's sloshed around out there by Bill Gates, Anthony Fauci. Do you really trust any of these policymakers over your life and health? Now, here is a case of one of those journalists in Australia talking about, quote, there is no good reason to ban two potential COVID cures. Let's hear what he has to say. It's a short clip.
Second wave of infections, and I'm not just talking about the second wave here in Australia. You also see this second wave in New Zealand in the last few days. 58 new community infections there. And you see it very much in Japan, in fact, and also in some countries that lock down hard, like France and also Spain then relax, then the virus comes back, which is a warning. This virus is not going away. Now, one positive thing, though, about these figures, while the new cases are going up in some countries and by a lot, the deaths are not going up by anywhere near as much as they once did, except in Victoria. So elsewhere, you might conclude they've got better at treating the sick or in protecting people in aged care. But the second wave, it has made politicians more desperate to offer you hope that there is a vaccine. We're being told by our authorities as soon as mid-next year, maybe, Christmas next year, and then the bans will be gone. And maybe we will get a vaccine that fast, although a lot of experts are saying that would actually be a miracle, and we don't know how effective any vaccine would be. But now around the world, there is this race to find the vaccine. The company that discovers it first will make billions of dollars. But what if there was already a cure out there, so cheap, using generic drugs? What if we didn't need to see people dying right now? What if we didn't need these lockdowns? What if we might not even need a vaccine if we just have a perfectly simple cure? And the thing is, there may actually be two such cures, both cheap, generic drugs. And that's perhaps why there's no buzz about them, because there's no money, no big money in generic no-label drugs, not for the big pharma companies. Now, I've told you already about one of these possible cures. It's the anti-malarial drug hydroxychloroquine. Take that with zinc, because that's important, with zinc. Here again is Dr. Harvey Risch. He's a professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health, and he's been arguing for months that hydroxychloroquine given to vulnerable people early and with zinc is the key to defeating this virus.
It's a very efficient, useful treatment when used in the first few days of symptoms of the illness, and used in conjunction with zinc and with an antibiotic like azithromycin or doxycycline, it reduces the risk of hospitalization and mortality dramatically in high-risk patients. So these are people over age 60 or with diabetes or obese or other chronic diseases. They're the ones who need to be treated, and they're the ones in whom the medication works very well.
Yet around Australia, GPs are warned not to prescribe this hydroxychloroquine. In Victoria, it's even banned. And that's because, in part, the National COVID-19 Clinical Evidence Task Force says evidence indicates that hydroxychloroquine is potentially harmful and no more effective than standard care in treating patients with COVID-19. And that evidence informing this recommendation comes from 9 randomised trials. Except, as I've said it before, and as I've said in my newspaper columns this morning, two huge problems with these 9 trials that this task force looked at, of the 70 or more studies it could have checked. First, the biggest study it relied on actually overdosed patients on hydroxychloroquine for some bizarre reason, gave them 6 to 12 times the recommended dose. No wonder some of them died. What's more, every single one of the 9 trials in this federal task force looked at failed to include zinc. Now, zinc is important. Hydroxychloroquine essentially works as a key to a door. The official term is ionophore. It coats the virus and, like a key, unlocks it for the zinc to enter and stop the virus replicating. So why are you not allowed to try this for yourself? But could we have 2 examples of our authorities ignoring a cheap cure? Professor Thomas Spirodi is a brilliant gastroenterologist who was critical in developing a world-first cure for peptic ulcers. He's a brilliant guy. And Spirodi's been saying that he now has a cure for this coronavirus too. Safer, in fact, than hydroxychloroquine, he says. A cheap head lice treatment called ivermectin. But again, to be taken with zinc as well as an antibiotic.
Prescription medication, you wouldn't use it alone. You want to reduce the dose that was done in the test tube, but you add 2 other things to it, such as doxycycline and zinc. There are a number of studies that are amazingly successful. We're talking close to 100%. In fact, we haven't seen a result yet under 100%. Looks like corona. It is very simple to kill.
Now, but caution, this treatment is based on very limited data, no double-blind studies and all that kind of stuff, simply treating people in the field. And a lot of other doctors say, where's the evidence? But note again, zinc. The thing is that, like hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin is an IO4, which is a drug that binds with the virus, gets through its lipid or fatty membrane, dissolves it, and either kills the virus or...
Okay, now where do we have any journalists, mainstream journalists in the United States, either writing or broadcasting about two, there's actually four medicines that are safe to use, safer than aspirin. When used at the proper dose early, we'll have amazing results. By the way, there are now 53 studies in the peer-reviewed literature, and that person who came on to make the first gentleman, he's an MD, PhD. He is the top epidemiologist at Yale. He has published 300 articles in peer-reviewed literature. He sits on the board of, I believe, a half a dozen major scientific publications. And he said, not in that interview, but I've heard him in a separate interview, say that hydroxychloroquine is the safest drug with the greatest results that he's ever seen in his entire career. Wouldn't you think that at least someone in the media, like 60 Minutes, would want to do a story on it? Not when you realize where your money comes from, Big Pharma. Hey, and if you've got an itchy nose, and some of you do, and it's annoying, and they show someone itching their nose in public, and everyone going, oh, look at that. Well, take this drug once a day, and then you don't have any more itchies. It will cause a stroke, and you'll die, but buy it now. And everyone smiles. Do you ever notice that all these, I'd rather have an itchy nose and live than have, let's say, their asthma, drug, which can kill you, their sleep medication, which can kill you, their arthritis drug that will kill you. Almost everything they have kills you or injures you. And then don't get near someone with tuberculosis. How would you know? God, so dumb. So let's just be aware we're being played. Now, we're going to go to some good news, positive information, to let you know, hey, for all of you who've been working hard, who've had really good upbringings with parents and grandparents and others who cared about you, and you've applied what you've learned, making mistakes and acting out as we all do, but the principle core values you've maintained, and today you have succeeded at what you've done, and you're recognized by your community, your family, as contributing something above and beyond. I want to acknowledge you all. I just want to mention also that this is the last 5 days that I'll be on WBAI. The station program director asked me not to mention anything, and I had planned every day to give a list of positive outcomes for BAI to help the station survive if it chose to use any of these suggestions I had made, but that information evidently has been gagged and censored, so okay, fine. I'll just say that I won't be here, but I'll be on the radio every day starting next Monday on PRN. You can listen. Let me give you the number. Write it down now because I'm not going to be on this station after Friday. Write it down. And I want this station to succeed. I want it to thrive. I want it to get up off its deathbed. But to do that, it's going to have to decide which changes it wants to make, and that's up to them because they have chosen not to listen to any I have suggested, which is their right. Listen live every day, including Tuesday evenings at 7 p.m. to the Progressive Commentary Hour by calling 774-337-6068, 774-337-6068. Or you can download the show and listen on the archives, 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. And if anybody would like to call in and ask a question or make a statement, our voicemail is 862-800-6805, 862-800-6805. Also, you can get a free PRN newsletter, and these are really comprehensive. And we're not ideological. We don't lean left or right. We look for the truth, and wherever it's at, that's what we share. Just go to prnstudio@gmail.com, prnstudio@gmail.com, and that way you get it. All right? Also, this weekend, I'm having a webinar, and that webinar is entitled Developing a Positive and Resilient Attitude for the Times Ahead. Let's just be honest. Our world has entered an era of unprecedented challenges and disasters, crisis, and social upheavals that are dramatically reshaping our personal lives and our cities and our communities and our federal government and the institutions. We're going towards fascism. We're going towards oligarchical rule over the technocrats who head all of our agencies and media. Already we're witnessing a tragic increase in people's lives being upended, which is contributing to rising rates of physical and psychological distress and illness. And the task before us to develop a healthy physical and mental resilience and the ability to spring back quickly in the face of uncontrollable forces, this requires developing a skill set that remains positive about ourselves in order to carry on with our lives. Currently, even without announcing, it was full. So don't try to get on. It's full. I called this morning and I asked Glenn, can you get a broader bandwidth? And he said he's going to try. So if we can get a broader bandwidth, don't try to get on now. It's not possible. We're packed. But I am going to spend 2 hours taking people's questions about the issues in their life that they would like to see addressed. I'm also going to talk about all the different ways that we can get ourselves out of harm's way. This will not be the same information as my last one, what to do when disaster strikes. I'm not going to talk about how to fireproof your home and all that. That's already done. But I am going to go through what I see the future to be and how to get ahead of these crises. And finally, I will be continuing, because people are all concerned, if you're not going to be on BAI, you're going to do the retreat, which was for BAI. And the answer is yes, of course we are. Because we have already spent 1,400 hours, a staff of 20, all professionals, working on putting everything together to make this retreat just work, as all of them have, and help people change their lives for the better. And also, it's the same time I'm doing a brand new anti-aging study, all brand new protocols. Nothing that people took in the last one will they be taking this time. This is the cutting edge. I believe, and again, it's a hypothesis, I believe that with a brand new 2-week protocol, I can achieve what otherwise took 90 days or 3 months. And I also believe that the younger people are and the more determined they are, the greater the outcome to really turn back the clock on their aging. And we'll be taking the blood workups before and after, and I'll be there for the whole thing every day with everyone. So that's happening as well. And if anybody's interested, last call. This will be the last retreat because the whole place has been repurposed. You can call Lou Ann Panessi. She's the gatekeeper. 903-881-7008. 903-881-7008. Now to some really good news, and that is, before we complain any more about what's wrong in the world, why don't we just stop for a moment and see how much cooperation and love and positive energy and help are given daily by people all over this wonderful country, and we're acting like none of that exists, that no progress was made because of the people who were in the civil rights movement or before them. It's not true. We've made progress. We still have other things to address, but that shouldn't be 100% of all of our attention, because then nothing else will matter. Global warming won't matter. You know, income inequality won't matter. Corruption in all bodies of politics from your local city council that are just septic, and a mayor that is a buffoon, and a governor who should be in prison, in my opinion, for life for what he did to those senior citizens, putting him back with COVID virus into a nursing home, infecting everyone, they died, and he gives a political statement to get out of jail. No, no. There's more to life than our crisis. There's more to our life than whoever has captured the microphone or the platform and is beating their chest because they want their ideology to be rammed down everyone's throat. Microaggressions and trigger words and the erasing someone's achievements like Wikipedia and using the internet because they've got a friend in the people behind Google and Facebook and Twitter. No, that doesn't work for all of us. Let me give you some examples. And I'm only giving you some of the examples today. Let's just take the Japanese. How many Japanese? 1.3 million, and half of them are pure Japanese ancestry, are living in the United States. The Japanese began migrating to the United States in significant numbers following the political, cultural, and social changes stemming from the Meiji Restoration in 1868. Most settled in either Hawaii or along the West Coast, and new immigrants from Japan were permitted after 1924. Almost all pre-World War II Japanese Americans born after this time were born in the United States. Now, during World War II, an estimated 120,000 Japanese Americans and Japanese nationals were forcibly interned in despicable conditions in 10 different camps. Japanese Americans have the largest showing of any ethnic group in nationwide advanced placement testing every year. They're one of the smallest groups, and they're the smartest. They're highly disciplined. I'm not talking about perfection. I'm just talking about they don't lose focus on what they want to achieve. And a large majority of Japanese Americans obtain post-secondary degrees. It is not uncommon for a Japanese American who's gone to college to have a master's, MBA, or in the sciences in particular, PhDs, very achieved. Biochemist Harvey Tano became the first Japanese-American elected to the National Academy of Sciences. James Peterson won the 1987 Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his methods of synthesizing crown ethers. Yasuhiro Ambua won the 2008 Nobel Prize in Physics for his work on quantum chromosome dynamics and spontaneous symmetry breaking. Shuji Nakamura won the 2014 Nobel Prize in Physics for the invention of efficient blue light emitting diodes. Architect Minoru Yamasaki designed the original World Trade Center, which was completed in 1973. Mind you, because of time, I'm only limiting it to a handful instead of the thousands of achievements, the Japanese. But let's take the Filipinos. When was the last time anyone talked about Filipinos? Well, there's 3.8 million of them in the United States. And the first documented presence of Filipinos in what is now the United States dates back to October 1587 around Morro Bay in California. The first permanent Filipino settlement was in Louisiana in 1763. Now, the Filipinos served in the Battle of New Orleans during the closing stages of the War of 1812. Filipinos worked as cowboys and ranch hands in the 1800s, but you never see them depicted. By 1904, Filipino peoples of different ethnic backgrounds were displayed at the Louisiana Purchase Exposition as part of a human zoo. Very degrading, very sexist, racist. But they go beyond their limitations, meaning you put them in a cell, they'll get out. You put a limitation, you put a border around them, you moniker them, they'll exceed it. During the 1920s, Filipinos started immigrating to the United States as unskilled labor. Filipino Americans have traditionally been socially conservative. Filipino Americans had the largest proportion of Republicans among Asian Americans, polled. And normally that's a position held by Vietnamese Americans till the 2012 election. And during World War II, some 250,000 to 400,000 Filipinos served the United States military. The U.S. government promised these soldiers all the benefits afforded to other veterans. However, in 1946, the United States Congress passed the Rescission Act of 1946, which stripped Filipino veterans of the promised benefits. One estimate claims that money is due to these veterans for back pay and other benefits, exceeded $1 billion. And Bobby Murphy co-founded Snapchat, and Tanki Sakyue, Chief Justice of California, and Babette Bolivar was Rear Admiral, U.S. Navy, Women's Divers Hall of Fame inductee. There are many Filipinos in the military and at all levels, from admirals and generals. And the most famous Filipinos are in the entertainment industry, and they have hundreds in that industry. Then you have your Koreans, about 1.8 million South Koreans in the United States. The U.S. is home to the largest Korean diaspora community in the world. One of the first Korean Americans was Seo Jae Pai, or Philip is his name, who came to America shortly after participating in an abortive coup with other progressives to institute political reforms in 1884. He became a citizen in 1890 and earned a medical degree in 1892 from what is now George Washington University. And throughout his life, he strove to educate Koreans in the ideals of freedom and democracy and press the U.S. government for Korean independence. He died during the Korean War. And An Chang Ho, H-O, pen name Dosan, a Protestant social activist, came to the United States in 1902 for education. And he founded the Friendship Society in 1903 and the Mutual Assistance Society. He was a political activist during the Japanese occupation of Korea, and there is a memorial built in his honor in downtown Riverside, California. And Korean immigrant Ri came to the United States in 1904 and earned a bachelor's degree from George Washington University in 1907, a master's degree at Harvard University, and a Ph.D. from Princeton University in 1910, where it was very difficult for a foreign student to even get in. In 1910, he returned to Korea and became a political activist and later became the first president of the Republic of Korea. There are more registered Korean Americans than registered Democrats, by the way. But during the last four elections, a small majority voted Democrat. But they have continued to make positive contributions to the world. Nelson Chai, former CEO of the New York Stock Exchange. Don Wong Chang, founder of Forever 21, billionaire. David Lee, former senior vice president of finance at Best Buy. Gideon Yu, co-owner of San Francisco 49ers. Bandy Lee, psychiatrist with Yale University and co-author of the book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. Peter Kim, president of Merck. Juan Hong, division head and professor at the University of Texas MD Anderson Center. Jong Kim, president of Bell Labs. Mind you, I'm only giving you a small insight into the plethora of individuals who've made major contributions and improved the quality of lives of not just people from their ethnicity and sharing their culture, but all of our lives are benefited by this. And by the way, it's notable that Koreans are in not just the entertainment industry, but they're very big in journalism, music, and the arts. And then you have the Indians, 5.2 million. The first Indians brought to the colonies by the East Indian Company are indentured servants. The Nationalization Act of 1790 made them, as well as all others who were of Asian descent, ineligible for citizenship. And the first significant wave of Indian immigrants, meaning a large majority of Sikhs, a minority group in India that experienced a lot of discrimination from the Hindu majority, entered the United States in the 19th century. In 1890s, Canadian steamship companies recruited Sikh farmers and economic opportunities in British Columbia. There were racist attacks in British Columbia, however, prompted the Sikhs and the new Sikh immigrants to move down the Pacific coast where they worked in lumber mills and in the railroad industry. And many Sikhs settled in California and formed close ties to Mexican Americans. The Bellingham riots in Bellingham, Washington, on September 5, 1907, epitomized the low tolerance in the United States for Indians and Sikhs, and anti-Asian racism was embedded in the U.S. politics and culture in the early 20th century. In 1923, the United States versus Bhagat Singh thinned that Indians were ineligible for citizenship because they were not, quote, free white persons. The beginning of the 21st century marked a huge migration trend from India to the United States, and Indian Americans continuously outpaced every other ethnic group socioeconomically per U.S. citizen census statistics. Indians formed the second largest group of physicians, medical doctors, after non-Hispanic whites. According to the Pew Research, 72% had obtained a bachelor degree and 40% had obtained a postdoctoral degree, whereas all Americans 19% had obtained a bachelor's degree and 11% had obtained a postgraduate degree. They are the richest and most successful ethnic group in the United States. Did you know that? Hardworking, honest, and they save lives. Did you ever ask about how did someone who came from a poor background in another country end up doing your neurosurgery or helping to do a cataract transplant? I mean, we take for granted so much. Just look at Banerjee, awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences. Gobind Khurana, a Nobel Prize in Medicine. Then you had Chandrasekhar, Nobel Prize in Physics, and Ramakrishna, Nobel Prize in Chemistry, and current President of the Royal Society, and Professor of Economics at Harvard University, Sen, and Nobel Prize winner in Economic Sciences, and Sundar Pichai, former chairman of and CEO of Google, and Nikki Haley, later appointed U.S. I'm not a fan of Nikki Haley, but she was successful U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. And then you have Dean of Harvard College, Rakesh Khurana, and Vivek Murthy, and CEO of Microsoft, and Nora Jones, multiple Grammy Award winner, and Dean of Engineering at MIT and Director of the National Science Foundation is Subra Suresh. And look at the CEO of MasterCard. Look at the President of Standard & Poor's. Look at the Dean of Harvard's Business School. Look at the Chief Economist at the International Monetary Fund. Look at the co-founder of Chippendales. Look at the former chairman of Pepsi-Cola. And look at the CEO of Nokia. And look at the CEO, Vikram Pandit, of Citigroup. There are just too many presidents, founders, and CEOs to list. But understand, there are a lot of them. Now, why is this important? Because every day these people put their unique skills to work. These people weren't born trust babies. These people weren't born from affluent families. These people worked themselves up. With few exceptions, they had the patience, the strength of character, the discipline, the fortitude to assimilate and contribute. Just think of that. I mean, I have friends who are Indian Americans, and we would all go out to a Madras Woodlands, a wonderful, in my opinion, the best Indian restaurant. I think it closed long ago in New York. And we would sit and we would talk about our cultures, cultural similarities and cultural differences, and what we enjoyed about each other's cultures or what we challenged about each other's cultures. That's the kind of dialogue you need, not screaming in someone's face. Now, I don't have time today to get to the Latinos. And by the way, the numbers you've been told about Latinos in the United States are grossly underestimated. But you talk about some magnificent achievements of how the Latino community has benefited everyone's quality of life. Well, I have, and mind you, I'm only giving you about 30 of the most interesting ones today. There are thousands. And then Iranians, 1.5 million. I'll give you those tomorrow. Nigerians, what a group. They're the largest of African populations in the United States. Phenomenal educational status. I mean, 4% of Nigerians hold PhD degrees compared to 1% of the general population. So I'll give you these wonderful achievements to let you know we have a lot going for us in this country. We're not dead. We're not burned out. We're not all corrupt. We're not all racist. And there's a lot of hope. Let me ask you this. How are we going to save ourselves if we keep looking down into the hole of despair and the abyss of what has been behind us? Someone's got to look ahead and look up and look at those who've created something. We can say, if they did it, I can do it. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.